Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. If you are an Eagles fan, you've probably been gritting your teeth the past few weeks. The Birds eked out a win over Atlanta and lost by a touchdown to the Bucks, and most certainly have not been in Super Bowl form. Does this change in any degree this Sunday? Quarterback Carson Wentz has been cleared to play against the Colts, but he hasn't seen regular season action for over 9 months, and there are other significant players still out with injuries. What can we realistically expect this season from an Eagles team and coach who cemented their place as a beloved part of Philly sports lore February 4th of this year? Joining us in studio, Marcus Hayes, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Hi, Marcus, and welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Ray Dinger is a sports commentator for NBC Sports Philadelphia. Good to see you again, Ray.
Good to see you, too.
By the way, we'll also talk about the Phillies, the Sixers, new GM there, Flyers, and the Union a bit later. And we'll hear what you have to say at home or on the road. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @whyyradiotimes. So Carson Wentz has been cleared medically. He will start at the Link on Sunday against the Colts. Anyone surprised that this is happening in week three?
I think, Ray, we kind of expected it to be a bit delayed, but I think if it was week four, if it was October, we'd be a little bit more surprised than week two. I thought maybe week three, maybe week two, maybe week three, but certainly if it was week four or five, there might have been something more amiss.
Well, usually clearance, full clearance happens after a year, right? This has been 9 months.
It can be the severity of the injury dictates that, and each injury is different, and each individual is different, and a lot of it depends about how aggressively the athlete pursues his rehabilitation. And Carson Wentz has been legendarily dedicated to coming back, so you knew that he would be on the short end of the scale in terms of coming back. But the Eagles were very clear, very very clear from the beginning, that they weren't going to rush this process, that they weren't just viewing it as a one-year proposition. I mean, they view him as the cornerstone of this team for the next decade.
Yeah.
So they weren't going to put him at any undue risk. If it was a matter of holding him out for an extra couple weeks, maybe an extra month, they were prepared to do that. But I think they felt like, and some people have said that this was a response to them losing in Tampa last week, that all of a sudden there's a sense of panic and now urgency, and no, it doesn't matter. We have to get
him
on the field
early.
Right now.
Yeah,
it is, and they wouldn't be doing that. I think that I felt all along it would either be this week or next week in Tennessee, because the real big game coming up is a couple weeks down the road when they have to play Minnesota, which is a rematch of the championship game.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they wanted to have Wentz for that game, but you didn't want that to be his first game. I mean, you wanted him to come back and get a little live action before that. So
sure, there's some rust.
So, yeah, so the fact that it's this week, I don't find all that surprising.
So Coach Doug Peterson says there are no limitations. He's not going to coach scared in calling plays. Is this realistic, Marcus?
No, I don't think that that's completely honest and forthcoming. I have a hard time believing they're going to have the same type of plays week three this year that they'll have week three next year, assuming Carson Wentz remains healthy, and certainly not the kind of plays they had week three last year. But I will say this, 3 weeks ago, Carson lost the bulky brace. He didn't wear the big, you know, composite brace for any of the time that we saw him working, whether it was before preseason games or early in practices, and I haven't seen it since. And the other thing I'll say is, having watched Carson Wentz for 3 years now, he looks better right now than at any point he's looked, as far as footwork and mechanics and strength and arm strength and precision. And he just looks great.
How so? How'd that happen?
Well, just practice. I mean, he was a very raw talent when he was drafted. And when they drafted him, you'll remember, they did so having signed Sam Bradford to a 2-year contract and expected Carson Wentz to not play at all his first season. They actually signed a very expensive backup quarterback so Carson Wentz wouldn't be activated his first season. Then Teddy Bridgewater in Minnesota got hurt. They traded Sam Bradford and made Carson Wentz the starter because he had progressed so quickly during a preseason where he only played a little bit in one game because he broke a collarbone or a rib.
Yeah.
So it's just he's a different type of talent. He's better than they ever thought, and he's the kind of guy who you expect to win a lot, to have a lot of postseason honors, Pro Bowls, All-Pro spots, and you expect him to be in Canton if all things go well. And I know that's very premature, but he's the best quarterback I've seen Philadelphia have, including the film and live stuff I saw of Ron Jaworski. Wow. He's just special.
And a risk taker. And do we see much of that on Sunday against the Colts, Ray?
I'm sure the coaches will spend all week telling him, don't take unnecessary chances, yeah. Don't go running.
Stay in the pocket.
You
know, yeah.
Try and stay in the pocket, but he won't. I mean, you can tell him all this stuff, and I'm sure they will. But once he gets out there and the game starts to play at NFL speed and things start happening around him, he's going to do what all athletes do, which is he'll fall back on his instincts. And his instincts are going to be to try to make every play. And so, I mean, they will try to tell him, I think the one area where they'll try to tell him, look, don't run. Well, of course he's going to run. And they'll try to tell him, don't scramble, don't extend plays unnecessarily. If you're in trouble, just throw the ball away. That's not his nature. I mean, his nature is going to try to be to make every play. The one thing that and he is a very smart, he's very, very bright, football bright and also just inherently bright. The one thing I think you will see him do is if he runs, I think he will probably do the slide and take the yardage, but yeah. Avoid the hit. Yeah. If he's near the sidelines, rather than drop his shoulder and try and pick up an extra 3 yards, he'll probably step out of bounds. I think he will do that initially. But the idea that you're going to take this guy and make him into Peyton Manning, just a pure pocket passer, you know, that's not going to happen, nor should it happen.
He's got to get used to that knee, though. There's a different dynamic. I read that there's a little bit more wiggle in the knee. No, it's not as tight
any player that's been through this will tell you that it feels different. It just feels different when you start playing on it. And you have part of what you have to overcome is that mental hurdle of saying, okay, I am okay. I am all right. I can do the things I used to do. And ultimately, you'll work your way back to the level that you were before. But it's not going to be there initially. No one should expect it to be.
Nick Foles, did he do the Super Bowl MVP? Did he do what was expected of him in the first couple games, Marcus?
You know, no, I don't think so. I think he was a little disappointing, and I think he was a little disappointed. Ray and I have both seen him really from his rookie season, and there's not a lot of growth between then and now. He still does things that put the team in risk of losing the game, and that's really the genius of good quarterbacking. You have a capacity to help win the game, but you have a much greater capacity to lose the game. And he did things in the first two games. He threw passes and he tried to extend plays that, you know, he still doesn't realize that he's not capable of doing. And sometimes it puts his teammates in peril. I mean, there was a running back named Corey Clement who, you know, was nearly nearly lost his season because of Nick Foles thinking that Nick Foles was Brett Favre or Carson Wentz. And he's just not. When Nick Foles is his best, it's when he sort of plays within himself. And at that point, he can be a very good manager of a team and make plays. He's a competent NFL quarterback. But given the landscape of the NFL, I don't know that a lot of teams want that to get to the Super Bowl and win a Super Bowl over a span of, I guess it would be 19 or 20 wins.
So maybe he is in the right role. It was the whole question, of course, at the end of the season last year and after the Super Bowl, Foles, what should he do? Where should he be? And perhaps he certainly seems to be accepting all of this with grace. You know, Wentz is number two.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably a very good backup.
Yeah.
And spectacular in moments, as we saw in February.
Well, he's probably about as good a backup as there is in the NFL. And if he has to start, he can start and he can win games for you, as he demonstrated. I mean, he got on a roll last year in the postseason where he played not just well, but astoundingly well. I mean, as good as Carson Wentz is, and everything Marcus said is true, I mean, he's an extraordinary player who does absolutely have a chance to be in the Hall of Fame someday. But as good as Carson Wentz is, he couldn't have played better than Foles played in the Minnesota game or in the Super Bowl. I mean, that's how good Foles was. He's capable of that. But everything has to be exactly right around him. And the difference between the two of them really is that Wentz can make some of his best plays when everything else breaks down. He can take a broken play and turn it into a big play. if Nick tries to do that, usually bad things happen. For Nick to run the offense, everything kind of has to be on schedule. Everybody has to get their blocks. The receivers have to be open. And if you are, he'll deliver the ball, and he'll deliver the ball often enough for you to win the game. But if everything starts to collapse around you and he tries to salvage it, he will generally get in trouble, where sometimes Wentz will turn that into a big play for your side.
And that's kind of the dirty little secret about last season. Watching every minute of every game puts you in a position to say, okay, this is how the story unfolded. And what we saw was a pretty good team at the beginning of the year, and then we saw Carson Wentz sort of blossom in the middle of the year as the rest of the team got better around him. Then when Nick Foles stepped in, the offensive line was playing very, very well. The dirty little secret about last year and how good this offense was, you know, during the middle of the season, the offensive line wasn't all that great. By the end of the season, it was great. It was astoundingly great. The offensive line coach, Jeff Stoutland, probably deserved, you know, the team MVP award for what he did, especially having lost their best offensive lineman, Jason Peters, or their second best offensive lineman, because Lane Johnson is very, very, very good as well. All that said, everything sort of clicked into place for the Eagles really after week two last year. And, you know, they weren't lucky. They got better, and they were kind of on a schedule, and they were, you know, they peaked at the right time. But the most astounding part is they peaked despite losing four or five really, really important players, and there's only about 25 really important players on any team. So they lost 20% of their roster, and most of that is back, and they should be incredibly good this year once Carson Wentz is whole.
Okay. Back to the Falcons game for just a second, the first game of the season, Eagles with the win. Fans came alive with a variation of the Philly, or Marcus, as you call it, Philly Special, the sequel. Were you expecting something like that this early in the season? And what does this say about Doug Peterson and what we can expect from him moving forward in 2018?
He is absolutely a riverboat gambler. I didn't expect anything like that in week one with, you know, kind of so much on the line. If that fails, if that goes the other way, just like the Philly Special, if that fails at the goal line at halftime and it goes the other way, Doug Peterson, you know, is run out of town. But Doug Peterson doesn't care about being run out of town. He trusts his players. He trusts himself. He trusts his assistants to have coached them up correctly. And he wants them to have fun playing football. And I think Philadelphia Eagles fans like when their team has fun playing football.
Wait, how much more of that can we expect from him, right?
I don't think he's going to change. I think that he's...
How many different surprise plays can one coach have?
He has quite a few. Every week he does something that's a little bit different. He takes certain plays and tweaks them or turns them inside out, changes the formation, changes the design. He's a very tough... I would not want to have to coach against him, because everything kind of is prescribed, and Doug will always think and call outside the box.
We'll talk a little bit more about that Colts game coming up. Plus, we'll take some of your comments and calls. This is Radio Times. We've got in studio Ray Dittinger of NBC Sports Philadelphia and Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and Inquirer. Stay with us. There's more of Radio Times straight ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscawain, and it is an hour of Philly sports. We're talking about the Eagles, the Sixers, the Phillies, the Union, much more, and the Flyers as well. Joining us this hour, Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, and Ray Dittinger is a football analyst for NBC Sports Philadelphia. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we do have some comments coming in. But first, before we get to those, I just want to quickly check in about the game coming up on Sunday. So Andrew Luck and the Colts are in town, along with their new head coach, Doug Peterson's former offensive coordinator, Frank Reich. And we were talking earlier about what Peterson might have up his sleeve in terms of surprises. Obviously, nobody knows Peterson better than Reich, I would assume. So what do you see ahead for Sunday?
Well, I think that I think Frank was probably Marcus made the point about Jeff Stoutland being sort of the unheralded MVP of the team last year with the job he did with the offensive line. I think Frank Reich, kind of the same sort of thing. He was the offensive coordinator. And everyone's so focused on Doug, and Doug is the play caller. I think that, and part, this is partly a reflection of Frank's personality. Frank is a soft-spoken, self-effacing sort of person who didn't seek credit, nor did he want any credit, but he was a very important part of that offensive brain trust. He and Doug really worked together all week to build the game plan. Now, Doug called the plays, but Frank was a very had a very big hand in the preparation of the team and the preparation of the game plan. He's very smart. And so he will come into this game with a pretty good understanding of what the Eagles want to do and what their personnel can and can't do. And what kinds of things they do with the line of scrimmage, hand signals, things like that. He knows all that. The Eagles are going to have to change some things this week, given the fact that Frank knows them so well. They'll come up with some different plans. But one of the things that I thought about coming into this season was how was the Eagles team going to be impacted by the loss of two very good coaches in Frank Reich and John DeFilippo, who were both really good offensive coaches and big contributors to last season. You lost both of them this year, and this week you get to see Frank Reich, sure. Except he's going to be on the other sideline.
Yeah. So how do you think the Eagles fare against the Colts, Marcus?
It sort of hinges not only on, you know, how well Frank Reich sort of scouts himself, because it's his offense, his fingerprints are all over it, but also how effective he is against Jim Schwartz, the defensive coordinator, who he, you know, battled for 2 years, whose tendencies he probably knows better than any other defensive coordinator in the league as we speak right now. So, you know, I don't think it's going to be a walk. Andrew Luck, the very, very talented quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts, is healthy again. And when he's healthy, he's got as good an arm as anyone in the league. And, you know, this defense did not look particularly good.
Eagles defense.
The Eagles defense, yeah, did not look particularly good in Tampa Bay against Ryan Fitzpatrick, who, you know, has been spectacular to begin with, but he's the backup quarterback in Tampa Bay behind Jameis Winston for a reason, you know, and he's 35, going to be 36 years old. You know, and you don't know what Carson Wentz is going to be. You know, I'm a big believer in, it took a couple weeks last year for Carson Wentz and his receiving core to get their timing down. I don't see why that wouldn't be the case again, because he hasn't been practicing with the starters because Nick Foles had to.
There are a lot of moving parts.
So, yeah, kind of a toss-up. I don't know that the Eagles view this game the same way now as they might have 3 weeks ago.
Let's get to some comments. We've got an email from Kyle who says, how do your guests feel about how the Eagles should handle their upcoming opponents targeting Wentz's knee? And he is a target. Is he not, Ray?
I suppose I, but the quarterback always is. Yeah. I mean, the quarterback always is a target. I mean, he'll be prepared as well as anybody can be prepared. But every quarterback that gets on the field is the defense's preparation all begins with go get the quarterback. That's really kind of what the game has become. The way the rules are written now, it's very hard to play defense in the secondary. Almost any kind of contact is a penalty. It's very hard to play defense on the back end of your defense. The way you play defense now is at the line of scrimmage and getting pressure on the quarterback. Once the ball leaves the quarterback's hands, all the advantage goes to the offense. So from a defensive standpoint, your priority number one is get pressure on the quarterback, whether that's Carson Wentz, Andrew Luck, or whoever's playing quarterback in the NFL this Sunday.
What's the deal with the helmet rule? How does that work?
I have no idea. it seemed as there was an instance in the Eagles game in Tampa where a call was made, and we thought it was the helmet rule. We thought it was going to be called against the ball carrier because he'd lowered his head and put himself in a bad position. So nobody kind of know after, I think it was the third preseason game, maybe the second preseason game, there was such an outcry over so many weird interpretations or inconsistent interpretations about the helmet rule that it's kind of gone away. It kind of went away immediately and has gone away. I will say this, there are a lot fewer catastrophic hits. You know, I think the rule has had an effect on the type of hits that you'll see, but, you know, when the stakes rise, I'm not sure that changes. And just to address your, I think it was Kyle's comment about going after Brady's knee, I don't think football players generally go after something like that, number one. Number two, in 2008, or going into 2009, they adapted a rule that said you can't sort of casually roll into quarterback's knees anymore because Tom Brady lost a season because somebody rolled into his knee, and it seemed relatively malicious. So I don't think you're going to be seeing any headhunting or knee hunting.
You don't think anything. You don't see anything like that down the road when they when they meet up with the Patriots.
Maybe the Patriots, because all bets are off with those guys.
Does anybody here feel bad that they're 1-1-2?
No, they're a hard franchise to warm up to. And I'm not a Philadelphian. I'm not necessarily an Eagles fan, but it's easy to root against them.
They engender very, very little sympathy. The right. Patriots did. Initially, people kind of liked them because the franchise was kind of downtrodden early in its history and went through a lot of bad times and bad ownership. And, you know, people always kind of felt sorry for the Patriots. But once they got on top and they put this machine together up in New England, yeah, they're very hard to like and they're very hard to root for.
And they cheat.
And they cheat.
I think that's an overriding theme in the culture. So.
Well, they didn't get the last Super Bowl. So
that's right.
All right. So we've got a tweet, and the person who tweeted asks or says, the Eagles should consider picking up Kaepernick. Great stats when he was with San Francisco. So let's talk about Colin Kaepernick for just a moment. He and Nike create a big stir just a little while back with Nike's new ad campaign. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. What does this campaign do for Colin Kaepernick, who at this moment remains without a team, or does it hurt his chances of playing professional football again? Right?
I don't think he's going to play again. I mean, he's been away from the game for a while now.
Does he want to play? Has he said he wants? Does anybody know if he wants to play?
Well, he's suing for the right to play.
He's got a collusion grievance,
yeah. Which is going to trial, which is a win for him. But, you know, to address the tweet, I mean, the Eagles, I think last year after Wentz was injured, there was like a window where they knew that they were going to the playoffs and there wasn't a whole lot of urgency. And I wrote, look, maybe they should look at Kaepernick over Nate Sudfeld as a backup quarterback. Yeah. Nate Sudfeld in his second year as a professional is, I think, his first year on a roster. And we don't know what we have in him. We do know kind of what we have in Colin Kaepernick, who was at that point about a year and two-thirds removed from his last game. Because, you know, in my opinion, he's been blackballed by the ownership. They don't want any parts of him or his cause on their teams. And I don't think he fits now because they have three viable quarterbacks. So if your contention was Carson Wentz is going to start on the uninjured reserve and maybe come off and after 5 or 6 weeks, then maybe you have an argument. You have a conversation about that. But Colin Kaepernick there's no room for Colin Kaepernick on this team at this point.
We saw a lot of Nate Sudfeld during preseason, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I mean, he was not exactly an out-of-the-blue player. I mean, he had a really good college career at University of Indiana. Now, Indiana's not a football school. It's a basketball school. But if you watched him play, I mean, he had the size you're looking for in an NFL quarterback. He had a strong arm. The one thing you don't know is how smart is he and how coachable is he, which apparently he's both. The Redskins drafted him. He was on their practice squad. He was on their active roster. Then they put him on a practice squad. The Eagles claimed him and brought him in with the idea that, well, let's work with this guy and see what we can turn him into. And I had seen him play in college. I knew he had some ability. And once he got here with this coaching staff, they made great. They really developed him, I thought. And when he got a chance to play this preseason, because Wentz didn't play at all, and they were trying to be real super cautious with Nick Foles because they didn't want to get him hurt, so Sudfeld got the opportunity to play a lot in the preseason. And, you know, preseason football isn't always the most accurate barometer because it kind of is what it is. You're playing against a lot of guys that are going to wind up getting cut in a couple weeks anyway. But I thought if you're just looking at his mechanics, if you're just looking at his skill set and what he demonstrated, he looked to me like a guy that certainly could play in the NFL.
And the greatest argument for Nate Sudfeld is that the front office of the Philadelphia Eagles, which is on a heck of a winning streak, but especially Joe Douglas and Andy Weidel, the people who work beneath Howie Roseman, have not only located him, identified him as someone that could help the Eagles on their roster, but also Glassboro's Corey Clement, who had 100 yards and a touchdown as an undrafted player in the Super Bowl at running back. Stefan Wisniewski lobbying to have Stefan Wisniewski play offensive line instead of the guys that they drafted or their hand-picked guys. Jake Elliott, the kicker who kicked a 61-yard field goal that started a 9-game winning streak last year for the Eagles against the Giants, having faith in Nelson Aguilar, the wide receiver everybody gave up on, and trading Jordan Matthews, the wide receiver who was the best player, the best receiver on the team. These are all, you know, trading for Jay Ajayi, who has injury issues and attitude issues in Miami, but comes to Philadelphia and helps him win a Super Bowl. These moves are the best endorsement you can have for a guy like Nate Sudfeld, who they were very high on and who they chose to retain over Colin Kaepernick when they could have signed Colin Kaepernick for their, you know, their stretch run or their playoff run.
Bring us up. Let's get back to just for a moment the national anthem and player protest. Bring us up to date. Where do the NFL and the Players Association stand now on this suspended, relatively new NFL policy regarding player protest?
Well, it's been indicated to me that it's never going to be enforced.
Okay.
You know, it's the blowback was such that they were cowed into going to the negotiating table with the Players Association, who grieved that, look, you've changed the workplace environment in a union shop. That's ridiculous. And they were right. Number one. Number two, the volume of protest, the number of players protesting has dwindled to the point that the owners are just like, well, you know, we really don't have much. And they didn't lose much to begin with. This was all posturing and power and egotism from 32 billionaires who aren't used to being told no.
Why is player protest dwindling? Thoughts, Ray?
That's hard to say. I mean, there certainly isn't much attention being paid to it now. Television coverage, which initially they would show the anthem for a while there, and they would show the sideline, they would show what was happening on silence, but you're not getting that now. And to a large degree, I mean, you could ask somebody who even goes to the game, you know, what happened during the anthem today? Oh, geez, I didn't even notice. Was anybody kneeling? Did anybody come out late? It's hardly happening, but it kind of had gone away. It really, to a large degree, it had gone away before the president came out and made his statement, which re-inflamed the situation. It was kind of going away on its own. I think in Tampa, the only thing I think was that Michael Bennett came out late, right?
Yeah.
And that was it. I mean, just he stayed in the locker room and then came out later. But even Malcolm Jenkins, who's been pretty much identified with the movement, and I think has really taken on a pretty strong leadership position within the movement, I mean, he didn't even raise his fist. I mean, he stood and bowed his head on the sideline. But I think the only thing that constitutes what you're talking about, which is this kind of a demonstration, was one player who came out, who chose to stay in the locker room, but came out to start the game.
Jenkins and Bennett both stayed in the locker room in the preseason, during which would be, I guess, and that's not true. Jenkins raised his fist for one game. Then stayed in the locker room with Bennett and another player who I think has since been cut, and they came out later. But it just sort of lost steam. And it should be recognized that Jenkins was one of the co-leaders of the Players Coalition, which I guess negotiated or convinced.
It's like an $89 million commitment from the NFL.
Over
like
5 years to further the causes that they were, you know, further some of the causes that they were sort of protesting in favor of. So, you know, I think that's an issue. I think that also there's kind of a fatigue as well, not just with, you know, the fans and the media, certainly, but with among the players. And, you know, things have changed. I mean, the NFL has made a monetary commitment. Colin Kaepernick's collusion case is going to trial. So things are moving forward, and it becomes the question was always, why are you protesting, and what can we do to get you to stop it? You know, the NFL isn't shooting young black men on the street and, you know, and then getting their jobs back. That was kind of the issue for Colin Kaepernick. So it wasn't the NFL. The NFL was like, hey, we're being victimized here by your protest. Tell us how we can make it go away. And they've done something. Some would say not enough, but something to help make it go away. but they haven't rehired Colin Kaepernick or his right-hand man, Eric Reed, a safety/linebacker who also is currently being blackballed in the prime of his career, certainly prime of Kaepernick's career, maybe the last third of Eric Reed's career.
All right, we're taking your calls at 888-477-9499. We've got an email from Tom who says, what should the Eagles do about their defensive secondary? Too many burned, in quotation marks, defenders this season and last. Agree?
Certainly wasn't Tampa. I saw Jim Schwartz, the defensive coordinator, did his press conference the other day, and he used the term, if he used it once, he must have used it 10 times, they were sloppy. He said we were sloppy in that game. That's a pretty good description, actually. It was surprising to me that given the way Tampa Bay attacked the New Orleans Saints the week before, and Ryan Fitzpatrick threw for 400 yards and four touchdowns, and you had three receivers averaging over 20 yards per catch. You spent the whole week looking at that tape. You spent the whole week talking about the fact that there was a big play offense. And then you go into that game, and the very first play, you give up a 75-yard touchdown.
Mm-hmm. That,
to me, was very surprising. Listen, give the Buccaneers credit for executing extremely well. They protected the quarterback well. Fitzpatrick played terrific, and they do have very good receivers. If you don't get pressure on the quarterback, those guys are going to get open and are going to hurt you. But I thought from a defensive standpoint, I thought the Eagles played very poorly. I didn't think they adjusted their coverages in the second half. I thought they gave up too many easy throws underneath. They gave up too many big plays early that put them in the hole, and then once they were behind, they gave up too many underneath throws that allowed Tampa Bay to get first downs and control the clock. I just thought they did a poor job of adjusting to the situation.
So, Marcus, going into the break, we've got about 30 seconds. Eagles fans who are listening right now, looking to the next game, Carson Wentz is in. What's your advice so that people aren't biting their fingernails to the quick? Give him a couple of weeks. Let him get his rhythm. Don't expect too much. Those are my thoughts. What are yours?
Carson Wentz will be best served if his offensive line plays well and his defensive line, as Ray mentioned, gets pressure on the quarterback and puts the ball back in his hand. They've spent like 35% of their resources on the defensive line, and it played probably its worst game against Tampa Bay, and that's why Tampa Bay won.
Marcus Hayes is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Ray Didinger is a football analyst for NBC Sports Philadelphia. It's a sports hour, this hour of Radio Times. We're going to tackle the Phillies. That's a bad combination of words there. Doesn't work. We'll take a look at the Phillies coming up here in just a moment on Radio Times. WHYY in Philadelphia. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are focusing on Philadelphia sports this hour of Radio Times. Promise the Phillies, but let's touch on the Sixers first, because we've got some news this week. A new general manager, Elton Brand. We're going to hear, I think, from him tomorrow. I think he's got a press conference tomorrow. As your colleague, Marcus, writes, Keith Pompey, Brand goes from playing for the Sixers head coach Brett Brown to being his boss in 23 months. So what's your take on the elevation of Elton Brand to GM?
It's an interesting choice of words, because we met with Brett Brown yesterday, and one of the questions I asked him, I said, well, who's your boss? He said, Josh Harris and David Blitzer, the owners, are my boss, will be my boss when we get a general manager. I want a partner. So Elton Brand is now Brett Brown's, at best, he's his partner. Hmm. And I have a hard time believing that when it comes the trade deadline/ mass cuts in free agency in the middle of the season, that Elton Brand's going to pound his fist on the table and have a voice louder than Brett Brown's.
Well, he's young, too, isn't he? And it takes a while to grow into that job?
He's 39, and he hasn't done this job before, but he's got a lot of people around him who understand how to run an organization, and they've been able – summertime is very, very important for general managers, and between he and Ned Cohen and Mark Eversley and Alex Rucker, who's kind of – they're kind of the brain trust, they have – different areas of specialization, whether it's analytics or relationships in a league or understanding the talent in a league, they got through it. They're a pretty good team now. The walls didn't fall down at their practice facility in Camden because Brett Brown was the guy with the final say. And I really don't believe that that's going to change very much, that Brett Brown will continue to be the guy with the final say, with a, you know, a contract extension that keeps him here for the next 5 years. And the ear of Josh Harris and David Blitzer, who are becoming more involved owners, as is the rest of the ownership group. When you had Brian Colangelo, who is no longer with them because of Burnergate, his wife had several burner Twitter accounts that disparaged the players. And when Sam Hinkie was here, the guy who sort of started all this process, quote unquote, you had a final say person. There has to be a final say person in every organization, whether it's the head coach slash general manager or the typical traditional general manager.
We have an email from Liam, and of course they were a tremendous amount of fun to watch last year, the Sixers. So Liam emails us and says, how did the Sixers go from eking into the finals to dominating the East? And will it even matter considering the East feels like the D-League next to the Western Conference once finals come around?
Well, none of those things are accurate.
Sorry, Liam. Liam.
It might be Liam Simmons, Ben Simmons' brother, who quit his job at UC Riverside as an assistant coach to become Ben's personal shooting coach over the summer, and very optimistic at that. But the Sixers eked their way nowhere. They were a 3 seed, got into the playoffs, and beat a pretty good Miami team and had a chance to beat a very good Boston team in the second round.
They open up against Boston, don't they?
I believe they do. It'll be great. And Boston's going to be a lot better this year. They got their two best players back, and that's also a dirty little secret. They were very, very good without Kyrie Irving and Hayward. So the Sixers are an interesting entity right now. Tomorrow we'll be shown the flow chart, the chain of command, as Brett Brown put it yesterday, which was weird to hear coming from a guy that's usually talking about, you know, basketball plays and health issues, talking about an org chart. And the question becomes, where do Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons, the two best players, where do they rank on the org chart? Because apparently in the general manager search, they consulted Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid.
Really?
I'm not making that up. That was my exact response. Like, if you're going to hire a coach or sign a big free agent or make a big trade, you might want to go to your star players and say, how do you think this guy's going to fit?
Yeah.
But probably not the guy that's going to be signing your contract, not your check, but you're, you know, signing you to your contract. So, yeah, there's a lot of weirdness down there. They're anything like the Phillies. They're anything but traditional right now.
Mm-hmm. I thought all along when I saw the list of candidates, the people they were talking about, I thought it was going to be Elton Brand because the way the Sixers are doing business now, the way the organization is structured, I didn't think they were going to go outside their think tank to bring in somebody else. I thought it was going to have to be somebody that was already part of their quote-unquote culture. And Brand seemed to fit the description. I mean, they have a very specific way of doing things. They have a very specific point of view and vision for how they want to build their team and how they want to do business. And so I don't think that they wanted to bring in somebody else from some other organization who was going to say, you know what, you guys have been doing so far. No, that's really not the way we want to do it. That isn't what they wanted to do. They wanted to stay on the path that they're on. So that, to me, said, okay, this is going to be an in-house decision. And I know that Brand is a very popular guy. And he had done some front office work with their minor league team. So he had a little bit of a hands-on kind of thing of understanding working behind a desk. So to me, it was a real obvious decision. I was just surprised it took so long to announce it.
Sixers are playing. They're going to play the Celtics again, you know, I think on Christmas Day this year. What's the significance of being chosen to play in a big holiday like that, Marcus?
It means that you've arrived. It means that you have players. And the NBA is a player-driven league. It means that you have players that people all over the country, all over the world, really, want to see play. The brilliance of Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons is that they're probably bigger. They've probably amplified their profiles via social media or their play or a combination of the two or their associations. You know, Ben Simmons is a LeBron James, you know, protege. They've amplified their presence. It's outsized of exactly who and what they are, which makes the Sixers more attractive than they might otherwise be. And, you know, honestly, they're also very, very good. Those two players are draws. And Joel Embiid, it's his first healthy offseason. He's in spectacular shape. Like I mentioned earlier, Ben Simmons hired his brother Liam to be his, like, Consigliere, his personal shooting coach, his dog walker, who knows what all he'll do. And Markelle Fultz, the number one overall pick, who didn't play last year because of shooting issues and a shoulder issue. You know, Brett Brown was very, very eager to tell us that he shot 150,000 shots over the summer, which means he shot 1,500 shots a day for 100 days. But I guess he was counting layups and free throws because it seems like that would hurt your shoulder more than
you
help
might think.
It. So,
well, this sounds like an exciting team. It sounds like an exciting team.
It's an intriguing team.
Oh, there's a difference.
Yeah, there's a big difference. They
still
were
exciting last year, not this year?
They were intriguing last year. I didn't find them to be particularly.
Compared to years previous.
Well, you know, this coffee cup is exciting compared to years previous. But they're an intriguing team. And a lot of it sort of hinges on whether they can get past the fact that neither Ben Simmons nor Markelle Fultz, their last two number one overall picks, has proven they can shoot in the NBA. And at three-point, as Brett Brown said yesterday, the three-pointer is king.
All right. Well, speaking of exciting, the Phillies were an exciting team earlier in the season, and they finally started to get people coming back to the park, you know, to watch them. And then, of course, rough August, rougher September, And I'll go back to you, Marcus, because I just read one of your columns on Tuesday. The headline was that the Phillies' decline only made sense. You saw this coming?
Well, yes and no. Ray's been there where you feel something that you should write, and then you sort of back off it because you report a little bit on it. You ask some questions, and I asked a few questions, and I was told that the general consensus was that the young players who had carried them to this point weren't going to fade. Then they lost 18 of their next 26. The players in question, most of them starting pitchers, sort of hit the levels that they'd hit before and have pitched worse since. That's not as true of Aaron Nola, their ace, who pitched well last night and a 16-5 with a 2.44 ERA. He's, you know, their best homegrown pitcher since Cole Hamels, who was the World Series MVP. They've got something very special in him. Rhys Hoskins in his first, I guess it would be about 190 games as a major leaguer, has 49 home runs, 118 RBIs, and an 892 OPS. It's on base plus slugging, and anything over 800 is really, really good, especially for a guy who's so young. They're a really good young team, and I think I and a lot of other people got caught up in the wave of enthusiasm. Couldn't believe how good they were.
It wasn't hard to get caught up in that enthusiasm.
Well, it was August 17th, and Aaron Nola was starting that night, and I wanted to see him pitch, and I said, you know what? And then he went out, and he pitched great, and I felt great for like 24 hours, and they lost four in a row. Then he pitched again, and he pitched great. And I was like, no, they're gonna be fine. They were right around, they were hovering around first place at that point. They didn't have a big lead. And then August happened.
Well, Ray Didinger, they're not mathematically out of it yet. And as a matter of fact, I think they play a bunch of games against the Braves here coming up. Mm-hmm. So, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen? But how do you see this very young team shaping up ahead of 2019?
Well, I read Marcus's column, and I totally understand because I've been there. I've been in that position where your eyes are telling you one thing, and then you say, well, I don't know if I really trust my – and so you talk to other people, and they talk you out of it, and it turns out that your instincts were correct. But there was logic behind it. The team had played well. The young players had been very good to that point. They had been very good in one-run games. And the idea that at a certain point, because so many of these young players had never played 162 major league games in a season, which is it's a grind. I mean, it's hard. I mean, mentally and physically, it's hard. And you would think this would just be at the point that they would get to the point of physical exhaustion and mental exhaustion.
That's what happened, you think?
Well, I think yes. Yeah. But the one thing that was counterbalancing it was the idea that the Matt Klintak, the general manager, had made some acquisitions right down that stretch where he had brought in some veteran players who you thought, okay, they can give these guys a little bit of a lift right now, help the young players through this stretch, and, you know, they might be able to make it to the finish line. Well, what happened was the gravity of baseball, it just caught up with them, you know, and a lot of the problems that there had been there all year that they'd kind of played through. I mean, offensively, they had always been down near the bottom of the league in terms of batting average, runs produced. Their run differential, they were barely a break-even team when the Braves were more than 100 runs to the plus side. I mean, there was a lot of just the mathematics of it didn't make sense that this team would win the pennant. And ultimately, over the course of a 162-game season, yeah, that all came to be true.
Well, Marcus, when we were off mic here before the show started, Gabe Kapler is still focused on 2018.
He is.
He still has a plan. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen.
We were asking yesterday, you know, Aaron Nola has pitched a lot of innings. Is there any benefit to having him finish out the year? You know, give him a couple of starts off, let him get a head start on the offseason. Hey, we're mathematically still in it. We're not shutting it down until we have to shut it down. And that's who Gabe Kapler is. He's an unorthodox manager. He's analytics-based. He'll start a reliever. He'll pinch hit for a guy who hasn't hit yet.
Does all that rotating?
I know. It makes me dizzy, and it really messes up my scorebook.
Does it mess up the players?
Kind of annoying. I think it does. I think a lot of the players, especially the veterans, don't like that at all.
Yeah.
But
like
nobody
in.
Likes change. You know, Doug Peterson goes for it a lot on fourth down. A lot of his veterans weren't crazy about that either. But he's unorthodox, and he's not particularly popular. I mean, I don't think in any arena he's endlessly positive to the point of you're like, are you serious? He uses unusual syntax. He's a slogan motto guy. Epicurus was the slogan of the day yesterday on the lineup board, and I'm not
definition.
Sure. I'm not sure a lot of those guys are reading those slogans or know how to pronounce Epicurus. You know, so. I don't know that any or all of it is working, but I do know that his team's in shape. They're the healthiest team in baseball, I believe, and they don't have anybody on the disabled list. And I don't know that any other manager could have gotten more out of a roster with so many players playing sort of out of position and so many players having never played a full major league season and one or two players having never played a full AAA season. Mm-hmm. So it's a very green team, but I will tell Phillies fans – it's going to be a good team next year and probably a good team the year after that because there are good players and they understand what they need to do to improve and they have shown the capacity to do that.
Quick look at the Flyers. Opening night's coming up fast. They're in Vegas October 4th. Preseason looking pretty good.
If they figure out kind of their goalie situation, yeah, they got four names in there. Alex Lyon, you know, got hurt last night in warm-ups. But again, this is if you ask me about exciting teams in reference to the Sixers and the Phillies, this is the team that excites me more than anybody else
because
it's really it's a team with a lot of names that could take big steps this year. The defenseman Ivan Provorov, it's his room. You know, all respect to the captain Claude Giroux, Ivan Provorov is, I think he's sort of the focal point of that team. They've got Nolan Patrick, Travis Konecny, who's kind of a James Dean character, just too cool for school. Giroux's playing the wing now. He can make another MVP run. It's an exciting team for me to watch going in because I like to see teams take that next step. Watching the Eagles, there are expectations. Watching the Phillies, I think they're a little too far away. This is a team that could be, you know, like a mid-playoff seed and make a little bit of noise, but every night is going to be interesting.
They've been trying for the longest time to find a goaltender. I mean, they've had some of the other pieces, but they haven't been able to get good, consistent goaltending. They have a kid now in Carter Hart who has been through juniors and everything regarded as maybe the next really, really good goalie. And the question is, how far away is he? I mean, is he ready to move up to the NHL this year, or is it next year? Now, he's going to start with the Phantoms, their minor league team, this year. But my feeling is I believe he's going to be playing for the big club, probably not to open the season, but I think at some point during the season he's going to emerge as the guy. And if he's really as good as everybody says, then they may have solved their biggest question.
Okay, for the close, we've got about 30 seconds left. Let's go back to the Eagles. What do the Birds have to do to get to Super Bowl 53?
Oh, I think they're going to win their division. I think they're the best, even the fact they've got some injuries now, they'll be getting those players back. And I think they're the best team in the East. I think they're better than the Giants, Cowboys, and Redskins. So that'll get them to the postseason. And then once you get to the postseason, it really comes down to who you play and where you play them. But, I mean, I think they'll be in the playoffs. And if you're in the playoffs, then you have a shot.
Marcus Hayes, what do you think?
Get Wentz on point and have Alshon Jeffrey, their number one receiver, return from his shoulder surgery. In an offense like that, you can't overstate the importance.
All right, Marcus Hayes, great to see you once again.
Thank you very much,
Mary. Marcus is a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News, and Ray Didinger, as always, a pleasure as well to have you here.
Great to see you, Mary.
Ray does analysis and commentary for NBC Sports Philadelphia, and as always, we invite you to check us out on social media and take a listen to some of our podcasts. You'll find it all at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. Thanks so much to you as well for joining us for today's Radio Times.